Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Let's Eat In. I'm your host, Kathy Owe, and we're here at Heritage Radio Network at Roberta's Pizza. We are in the middle of quite a April shower session, but that's all right. It's good for the plants, which we'll be talking about a lot at today's show. A quick word, today our program is brought to you by Edwards of Surrey, Virginia. The Edwards family has joined Heritage Foods USA and Newman Berkshire Farm to develop an all-natural product line featuring Surreyano hams, Berkshire smoked slice and slab bacon, and Berkshire smoked sausage links. New products are produced exclusively from purebred six-spotted Berkshire pigs raised completely outdoors on independent family farms. Find out more about Edwards cured meats at SW Edwards & Sons, edwardsvaham.com. That's the website. You can check them out. You know, it's always that time of the year when it gets mucky and rainy, but we have so much to look forward to. May flowers, as they say, but also edible greens. We have a few people here who know quite a bit about that. If you'd read my book, it's okay if you haven't. It's called The Art of Eating In. There is a chapter all about my dabbles in urban foraging. It's called From the Land, and in the chapter, I go on a tour with Wildman Steve Brill, who most of you should know as the kind of the number one edible foraging expert. Wildman is here today on the phone. Thanks so much for joining us.
Sure, happy to be here.
Great. So, Steve, do you have any upcoming tours?
Yes, I have tours every Saturday, Sunday, and holiday in the greater New York area. This Saturday, May 1st, we're going to Inwood Park in Manhattan. Sunday, May 2nd, we're going to Topstone Park in Connecticut. Saturday, May 8th, Muttontown Preserve in East Norwich, Long Island. Sunday, May 9th, Central Park. And if you go to my website, wildmansstevebrill.com, there's a lot of material about foraging there. And my tour calendar going up to December, when we pick wild persimmons.
Wow, that's amazing. You're still, it sounds like you're very busy, as usual, every year. Congratulations on keeping that up after so many years. And I know you have a new book coming out, too. Is that correct?
Yes. I'm working on a book called Foraging with Kids, for parents and teachers to use with kids to get them outdoors, get them hunting for the Japanese knotweed, the cattails, the wood sorrel, all the renewable resources. They're very easy to recognize what to do with them, related games, science projects, stories, folklore, history, poetry, and a lot of my artwork and photography. So it's sort of a literary children's book focusing on foraging and fun.
Oh, isn't that fantastic? Foraging with your kids. That's a great topic. So I know you have lots of other books. You guys can check them out at wildmansteveville.com. They're great resources, especially if you can't go on one of Steve's actual tours. But they're filled with illustrations, you know, the whole nine yards, recipes, which I love. We have a few other experts in the field, as it were, or the city's urban parks and cracks between the sidewalks. We have Lita Meredith. Thanks so much for coming on air.
My pleasure.
Lita has a book called the
The Locavore's Handbook.
I was going to say the Urban Forager's Handbook.
There is a chapter on urban foraging in there.
Right. And the book really covers the whole spectrum of foods for The Locavore. And
it's The Busy Person's Guide to Eating Local on a Budget is the subtitle for it, and sort of for all of us in the city with crazy schedules and small apartments, and can we still actually eat local, organic, and wild foods and not go crazy.
That's terrific. We also have Ava Chin from the New York Times. She writes a lot about urban foraging. You can check out, she's actually has a blog on the City Blogs. She is the urban forager.
Right, in the City Room section of the New York Times.
Terrific. Thanks so much for being here, Ava.
Oh, my pleasure.
So what have you guys been finding lately that has really caught your attention? What's really great right now? Anyone can start.
I think one of the things that I really enjoy the most is because we had the sudden heat wave about 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Lots of things are in bloom.
The cherry blossom came up way too early.
Came and went, sadly.
Yeah.
But in terms of dandelions, the blossoms were everywhere. And so one of the things that I really enjoyed doing was recently plucking the dandelion blossoms and using them to make a jelly.
What?
Yes. And more recently, too, what I've been doing is turning it into a dandelion wine. Right now, it's fermenting in a basement.
I have a recipe for dandelion wine in my first book. You have to collect a lot of dandelions, but it's really good.
Oh, really? Yeah. The flowers?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's definitely labor intensive, and it's about as slow foods gets, that and acorns, but I think it's well worth it. It tastes like a summer field. It tastes like honey, actually, wild honey.
Oh, that's gorgeous. Does it age? Does it increase in complexity and flavor with age?
You do have to age it for quite a while, you know, as with any homemade wine. But yes, like she said, it's slow food. It kind of needs to lose the yeasty flavor. Yeah. It's what she was saying with the flowers. There have been a lot of edible flowers right now. The violets mm-hmm. are blooming, and I've been throwing those in salads. And the red bud flowers, which taste a little bit like peas, which are one of my favorites, are still in season. They're starting to finish up now.
Red buds, okay. Yeah. Steve, I know you have a special kinship with the violet flower.
Oh, definitely. the violet originated in ancient Greece when Zeus got bored on Mount Olympus, came down to Earth, and took up with a wood nymph by the name of Violet. He disguised himself as a handsome young man so no one could recognize him. But then he got afraid his wife Hera would find out, and he'd never hear the end of it, being that she lived forever. So he disguised Violet by changing her into a cow. And when he went home, she got hungry and started eating the grass. But it was tough. It made her mouth hurt. She started to cry, and Zeus felt sorry for her and turned all her teardrops into violets. That's the origin of the violet. Now, you may think this is a myth, but it actually is not, because there's a second part to the story. I was doing a foraging tour a number of years ago, and there was a beautiful, magical creature who attended the tour. We started dating. She loves nature as much as I do. First, we went to the Galapagos Islands. Then we went to Antarctica. And a number of years ago, we got married. And 6 years ago,
It's a girl,
and her name is Violet, and if anyone ever turns her into a cow, she already knows what to eat. Yeah, and I've been also picking wisteria blossoms. Have any of you been using those?
Yeah.
They're just coming to season. They're wonderful. I put them into pancake batter. I've made wine with wisteria, which is as good as dandelion wine. Mm-hmm. And I also bake it into muffins and, of course, put it on top of ice creams and cake frosting. Mm.
Steve, do you dry it out before you bake it into muffins or something
like
that?
No, I use them fresh. They lose a lot of their flavor when mm-hmm. you dry them. I tried that. I'm not going to do that again.
Those smell so good and, pretty as a picture. You could just put in a vase and maybe once you're done looking at them, you could just snip them off and... That's fascinating, though. Muffins. Wow. So they're speckled with these beautiful bluish flowers.
Sure. I have a wild vegetarian cookbook as well as a general ID book and an early spring Northeast book. And I certainly have a lot of wisteria recipes in the cookbook. And they're delicious.
Yeah, you've got the wisteria wine recipe in the cookbook, if I remember right.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Wow.
Definitely.
My mind is...
Yeah, and I also recommend Lita's book, which is great.
Thanks, Steve.
Lita, do you have a wisteria or edible flower more recipes in there? Or
I have a bunch of dandelion recipes, more than one in there. And then some other wild plants, not specifically flowers, but I've got recipes like burdock stir fry. You can actually buy burdock as gobo, exactly, but if you have the patience, you can dig it up. It's notoriously difficult to get, but
if you find the right spot where there's no rocks in the soil and you go after it rains and you have a shovel, you can get a huge amount very, very quickly. I did that yesterday, and some of the burdock is now simmering in a soup with nut milk, with ramps, with garlic, some thyme, rosemary, and tarragon, and some Japanese knotweed that stayed fresh in my refrigerator because that season is over.
That season's done.
And they're all happily and simmering together with some miso and arrowroot pureed into the almond milk. And I'm going to have that soup when I get off the phone. But it was so easy digging up the burdock. I should have put it on YouTube.
Wow! Yeah,
it was just the right place. And the place I went to had tons of dryad saddle mushrooms. Have either of you used that one? That's quite delicious.
Oh yeah, they're huge.
They are. They're enormous. I haven't gotten those yet this year, but I'm sure I will.
Yes. Go to your spots now, because everywhere I go, there are dryad saddles, and people are sending me emails, what's this mushroom? There's dryad saddle in Virginia, and my friend in Connecticut is getting them. We found them in Prospect Park. We found them in Central Park, and they're just at the right stage. They get tough later on, and you can't use them anymore. And you could cook them, but then they're like cooked leather.
Right. Yep. Fantastic. Has anybody been finding morels lately?
You know, the morel hunting that I've done is out of the city. I have not had luck finding them in the city. So I'm looking forward to, in the next few weeks, hitting the morels, especially in the Midwest. You can find tons.
Yeah, that's the place. I'm the world's worst morel finder. And when I do find them, everyone on my tour gets them all except for me.
Would a dog help out in those situations?
Yeah. Like a truffle dog for morels? Yeah. I don't know.
I don't think so.
What about chanterelles? Is that something anybody finds?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
yeah, that's them. In the summer. That's like the end of July into late August.
Do you think we could find those in like Prospect Park, Central Park, Steve? Or
I've found cinnabar red chanterelles in Prospect Park. I've never found the orange chanterelles. I do a tour in Sugar Pond and Hastings on Hudson, where if there's been rain, we get a really huge crop. And a lot of my tours in Connecticut have them. I haven't seen them in city parks. Not that they don't grow there. I just probably haven't come across them, except for the cinnabar red ones. What about you guys?
No, I haven't found any.
No, just the cinnabars, like you.
Yeah, and I found like oyster mushrooms.
Oh, tons of oyster mushrooms
in Brooklyn.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those are my favorite.
You know, at Grand Army Plaza entrance to Prospect Park, and there's a guy at the farmer's market who sells cultivated mushrooms.
Sure, yeah.
And he has oysters and hen of the woods and stuff. And last fall, I had just done a tour in the park. And it was actually on the way back from the tour, I found just a huge amount of hen of the woods, with some people know as maitake. And I came out of the park at the farmer's market, and this guy is hawking his wares, and he says, look at this fantastic, maitake mushroom I have.
$14 for half a
exactly.
pound.
Exactly. And I let him kind of peek in my bag, and he started laughing and said, you're not going to be my customer. And I said,
last year and the year before were great years for those. I was finding them everywhere: Central Park, Prospect Park, Inwood Park, where I used to live in Queens. They grew on the street trees in Briarwood, right in front of my door and across the street.
Is that where the oyster mushrooms always grow? Is it? Again?
No, those were the maitake.
Oh,
the hen of the wood.
Okay, and they always are at kind of the base of.
They like oak trees.
Okay.
Yeah. And I have those on my website, wildmansteveBrill.com. And as far as the oysters go, I have a really nice oysters Newberg recipe
that has all of these high fat
cholesterol rich ingredients when you make it traditionally. And I use alternative things that you buy in the health store that don't have those ingredients, and it's fantastic.
And it's cheap. I'm really amazed because, oyster, all these mushrooms are such delicacies. And when you cultivate them, I don't know why it's so expensive, but...
Well, it's not even just the price. When you actually find a mushroom growing in the wild, that flavor is so different. It's so much more intense. I would say the same. I mean, the same thing is really true of the vegetation that you find, all the botanicals, but the mushrooms, for some reason, it's a different animal.
You get the terroir.
Even the burdock root.
Yeah,
I've had burdock root in restaurants, and there's just no comparison to what you dig up. You just need a shovel, a wet thyme, and a spot where there aren't rocks.
I think I once had a disappointment when I dug up a second-year burdock root, which is a little tough.
Yeah.
No good, right?
No
good.
No.
What you want then are the flower stalks, the immature flower stalks when they're coming up.
Yeah, they're dying in their second year because they're a biennial, so there's nothing left in the root. All the energy goes into the leaves and into the seeds and into the burrs, and that's the end of the plant.
Right.
Except for what remains on your clothes.
And all the dirt you dug. Yeah. You know what? You guys, you brought up, that's an interesting point about the taste is so much better when you get it wild. A lot of people will ask me, but it's not safe. You know, what about the city's toxicity? What about, what if the Parks Commission sprays fertilizers all over the place?
Well, luckily with the recession, that really hasn't been happening in the last couple of years.
Yeah, that stuff is expensive. Right.
So let the weeds grow. That's their saying. Let them be.
Well, there are certain things that you learn about, not to harvest too close to a super heavily trafficked road, and things like that. But, I feel pretty healthy.
Right. I people are really concerned. And, I saw this also, too, in, talking about urban agriculture in the city, people concerned about the quality of the soil. And I would assume...
Are some plants that actually are so good at storing toxins and heavy metals that they can be used to clean up soils, but that also then means you don't want to be eating them if they were growing somewhere that had lead in the soil or something. Alliums, all the onion family, are on that list.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're in the parks, you're pretty far away from major roads or anything.
Would you guys advocate only foraging then in parks, which are contained areas? There's not supposed to be industry, chemicals.
Well, let's put it this way. In terms of, I won't say anything about the parks, but one of the first times I found a wild carrot was in the Brooklyn Naval Yards, right? Now, of course, you use your head, right, when you're foraging. I wasn't going to eat something that I found in the Naval Yards, right? Precisely because you don't know what's in the ground, and for a century they've been working on that ground, right, using heavy metals, so you have to be careful. But I think you just have to use your head about where it is that you're foraging from.
And also you can learn to ID the plants even in areas that you can't harvest them. So if she's finding the wild carrot somewhere that is not good to harvest, but at least then you've identified the plant and then you can find it in a safer place.
Right.
Yeah, well, of course, with a wild carrot, you also have to beware of poison hemlock. There are many wild plants like dandelions and mulberries and cattails that have no poisonous lookalikes, but the wild carrot does. They're not that hard to tell apart. They may look alike, but they are not smell alike. The wild carrot smells clearly and distinctly like a carrot. And the poison hemlock smells sort of like a dead mouse.
Okay.
Close to. And then the place to collect those is in sandy fields near the seashore. That's where they get big. If they're competing with grass in a lawn, they're the size of the graphite in a lead pencil. But if they're in a field in Fort Tilden Park or empty lots in Rockaway, then you get substantial carrots, and you don't even need a shovel. You just reach in and pull. They are way more flavorful than the commercial carrots. They're not as sweet, and they have a much better texture when you cook them, so they don't turn into mush when you put them into carrot cake, soups, or cookies. And They're still in season now, but they're going to be going out of season pretty soon. Okay. as the growing parts of the plant take up the nutrients from the roots. And then the first-year plants that don't have the Queen Anne lace flower will go back into season at the end of September and stay there all winter. And as long as there are still some fragments of leaves up, which you can get well into December now with climate change taking hold, you can dig them up even in the winter.
And you can eat the greens, too, the beautiful feathery carrot greens.
Yeah, they're edible. I don't really care for them. What do you guys do with them to put them at the same level as ramps or daylilies or violets?
No, I don't.
I mean, I've played around with that, you know, just mincing them and using them as a seasoning. But there are so many other things that are much better.
The only thing I've ever done maybe is, like, cook them down in a big gumbo zerb stew, which is, like, this big... You know, greens.
Oh, and I just answered my own question. I forgot. I put them into stock. If I'm making vegetable stock, I boil carrot tops and any other greens that are a little bit past that I have in the refrigerator, potatoes, onions, garlic, savory herbs for a couple of hours and then strain everything out and use that as a base for soups and sauces.
Hey, wild greens stock. Mm-hmm. That's going to be my new veggie stock. Soon.
Well, a lot of, you know, she was talking about the stronger tastes in some wild foods. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that actually means they're more nutritious or have phytonutrients in them that are immune system boosters and things, because those strong tastes can indicate the presence of alkaloids and essential oils, which have medicinal properties. So, you know, I think your wild soup stock is probably going to be healthier than the regular kind.
It'll be like a tonic.
Tincture. I mean, when I first started foraging, there was no one ever heard of the word resveratrol, which is the stuff in red wine that helps lower cholesterol and protects you from heart disease. And, of course, that is in a berry that we all love called the autumn olive berry, one of the best-tasting fruits in the world. And I just recently found out that the wild mulberries, which you can get gallons of by shaking the branches over a drop cloth, have resveratrol, too. And that may even slow down aging. That's like the hot topic in anti-aging, anti-heart disease research. And there are also plants that are loaded with lycopene, which were not known when I started doing this stuff. And most of these plants haven't even been researched for nutrients and phytonutrients. So you eat this stuff, you're almost certainly getting things that may be discovered in another 20 years that are going to do you a lot of good, and they taste great.
Totally. I mean, mulberries are right beneath or above our heads, and people don't think of them really as food. Except for the birds.
People complain about them littering up the sidewalk, and I've got a neighbor with a great mulberry tree, and he's thrilled. We have a deal every year. He calls me when it's time, when they start dropping, and I come out, like Steve said, with the drop cloth.
Let's make some jam.
And I use the mulberries, and I love them, and he gets a clean sidewalk, so it's a win-win situation.
Okay.
Yeah, jam, ice cream, pie, puddings. You can put them into almost any kind of fruit dessert. They're not as sour as the berries you buy in the store. So a little bit of lemon juice, lime juice, or sumac concentrate, that's another wild plant that gives a sour flavor, seems to enhance the flavor.
Yeah, I feel that some people like less tart berries, too. They find blackberries, raspberries a little too tart for their taste. So mulberries a good compromise.
I would say that the only other plant that I can think of where... Or tree that I can think of that has a seed or a fruit that some people don't like as much, probably are the ginkgos, right? Because of the way that they smell. But it's the same kind of symbiotic relationship that you can have. If you have a ginkgo tree outside, as many of my friends and a lot of Brooklyn residents do, you'll oftentimes see in the round about November or so, lots of like older Asian grandmotherly types going to collect all the ginkgo nuts, at the bottom. And it's one of those things, I think, where it's like, particularly if you grow up in the city and you don't know what it is, you can be very suspicious of it. But in fact, it's actually, the nut is really quite delicious, you know, once you get past the putrid-smelling, fleshy part, right?
Yeah, the fruit you just discard. And the ginkgo actually saved the lives of some kids. In the Chinese version of Little Red Riding Hood, there were three sisters, And the older sister saw through the disguise of the wolf, and they went out into the back with the disguised wolf to collect ginkgos for the grandma, that was actually the wolf, to make her healthier. And they had a pulley and a rope. The older sister got the two younger kids safely away from the wolf up the ginkgo tree, and then she used the pulley to get herself up in the ginkgo tree, and then the wolf wanted to come up too, and she pulled the wolf up and then let go of the rope. And that was the end. That's the Chinese Little Red Riding Hood, but it was the ginkgo tree that saved them.
I can believe it. I mean, it's a power plant, as they say. The ginkgo has so many different benefits. Eva, what's something you like to make with the nuts?
I like to do it very plainly. Once you crack through the hard outer shell, I like to just saute it mm-hmm. in a little bit of olive oil with salt and pepper, which is like a pretty kind of traditional way to do it. It's got the consistency of edamame.
Right.
Right?
It's like
it's kind of chewy.
Earthy bean.
Yeah. And then once you saute it, it turns in this incredible jade-like color. Mm-hmm. It's like slightly translucent. They're really, really nice. Mm-hmm. And I just do it with salt and pepper. I mean, you can do it. One of the Japanese style ways to do it is you put it on a skewer.
Yeah.
You kind of like eat it as a, it makes snack. A nice party hors d'oeuvre.
Party snack, yeah.
Yes, that you, that. You know, serve with your other wild foods.
Can you steep it and make some tea? No.
I've never done
lost.
That. Okay. If you're thinking like the tincture that people take for memory and
yeah,
things
I'm
like
just
that,
thinking
that's
like
not made
Chinese
out of the nuts.
Right,
that's the leaf. That's
oh, the leaf.
Leaf.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
But I would think the nut would have the same nutrients, so you don't even have to make the tea.
But with protein, and, right?
Yeah, and I don't do well with teas anyway. They're diuretics, and then when I run into the bushes, 30 people follow me to see what I'm going to find. what I like to do, I put the ginkgo in rice dishes, I put it in soups, I put it in stir fry, and they have a fermented flavor to them. I'm a vegan, I don't eat cheese, so if I want to make a cheese salad dressing, I'll put in oil and vinegar, maybe some lecithin granules or miso to make it a little thicker and add some salt to it. And then I put in it all goes into the blender. I put in the ginkgos and the brewer's yeast, and between the two cheesy fermented flavors, you get a vegan cheese salad dressing.
Absolutely.
That's another one in my cookbook.
That sounds fabulous, because, you know, my thoughts on, you know, fermented beans is, you know, usually tofu or miso fermented stuff, and that's a great addition to that group, and you can make it yourself naturally. Wow.
Sure. Oh, one other thing, we'd mentioned stock before. Mm-hmm. If you want to make a fish stock, there's a seaweed called rockweed that's the most common seaweed, and it is a nice fishy flavor. And you put in your carrots and other vegetables and a little bit of wine and some seaweed and simmer it, very similar to the French traditional classic fish stock, except you're using the seaweed instead of the fish bones, and you get an incredible fish stock that you can then use to make a vegan fish recipe.
Oh, my gosh. That is just fascinating. You can just substitute. This is like magic. I'm learning so much. We could really go on here forever. Unfortunately, we're just about running out of time. I just wanted to ask you all a final question. What would you make for a wild forage feast or dinner that would be really impressive for someone you might want to go on a date?
Well, I did that, and we got married. I made oyster Newberg for my wife when I first met her. I made
cool.
mulberry vegan mulberry ice cream. I made a salad with ramps and violets and curly dock. I don't even remember what other greens, purslane, just everything that's out there, with the ginkgo salad dressing, which is her favorite dressing. I think that's what she married me for.
Oh, my goodness. What a success story. That's terrific. How about you guys?
Let's see. Well,
something impressive, you know, like
one of my
date meal worthy.
One of my favorite things to do with daylilies. right? Mm-hmm. Which were, they're now, the shoot anyway is sort of past its season. You can wait until the blossom comes out in the summertime. But what I like to do with daylilies, they're a wonderful shoot when they're in season. They taste a lot like a cross between, well, from my mind, they taste between a cross between a snap pea that tastes kind of sauteed mm-hmm. in like a wonderful oil.
Nice crisp.
And yeah. And what I like to do is I like to turn it into a ricotta pie.
Oh, gosh.
And do a nice little lattice work on top of it.
Wow.
And bake it for about 45 minutes or so.
Beautiful.
It's pretty yummy.
Beautiful.
That sounds wonderful.
It does.
It does.
I think,
Lita?
Wild mushroom risotto is hard to beat. So if it's, especially in the fall when all the wild mushrooms are abundant, that's near the top of the list. And I have yet to meet anyone who could resist my Spice Bush ice cream. So that's up there too.
Spice Bush ice cream.
That's something to look forward to this summer.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the mushrooms for the fall, definitely. Well, here we're in the throes of spring, so I hope everyone goes out and enjoys it. And you can follow what these guys are up to. Check out one of their walks, you know, wildmansteveville.com. Check out Lita Meredith. What's your website?
LitaMeredith.com, and just click on the Urban Homestead link, and you'll get all my classes.
All these classes. Ava, do you teach classes, too? No.
I teach journalism and creative writing to my students. Yeah. The foraging for me is more about the writing,
right.
About foraging. And for me personally, I'll go out, and I'll take friends here and there.
Right.
But for the most part, it's a little. I'm a little bit more like Thoreau, walking through the woods, except it happens to be Brooklyn.
Well, I'd love to have you as a guest expert on my tours, of course, either of you, if you're ever free.
That would be fantastic.
That would be
great. We should get together and do this.
That would be great.
So
the three of us.
Yeah.
Sure.
And I should bring a video camera. All you videographers out there, get on this. Please, let me know. Okay, so thanks so much for being here. I know you have to run off. Steve, thanks so much for taking the time out of your schedule.
Okay,
I hope you have that great
foraging lunch.
Happy
foraging,
thanks.
Everyone.
All right, happy foraging.
Happy
you
foraging
too.
To you.
And I wanted to thank the producers, Jack Inslee, Nat Wiener, everybody at Heritage Radio Network. We'll be back next week. Our sponsor is Edwards of Surrey, Virginia. I'm Kathy Arway, your host. Thanks so much.
The one you love.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.